Okay, how far did we get? Oh, look at that, two screens. Oh, how advantageous, eh? You'll have to crook your neck. Right, okay. So let's continue then. We did occipital frontalis last week, remembering that we had a muscle in the frontal area and we had a muscle in the occipital area with the subacranial aponeurosis over top, and that these muscles, that really the occipital part doesn't do a lot of pulling in the face, but frontalis does, which of course raises the eyebrows. The next one is orbicularis oculi. Orbicularis tends to denote a circular style of muscle. It arises from the medial side of the eye to the medial side of the eye. So it goes around in a circle like so. So we talk about how it starts medially, comes all the way around, and attaches medially. So we say it returns to the same attachment encircling the eye. As it encircles the eye, it does attach at a number of places. So it's not just hanging loose with that singular attachment medially. It, in fact, actually has a nasal, in the nasal part of the frontal bone, the frontal process of the maxilla, and the medial palpable ligament. So there are some various spots where this muscle doesn't attach. Again, it doesn't just float in this area. And it runs through the connective tissue of the eyelids and then the lacrimal bone. So it does have some attachments in there, but fundamentally, it is a circular muscle that runs around. Its functions: it closes and squints the eyes. So when you're squinting hard, you're using this muscle. It depresses the upper eyelid, which means it closes, right? Depression down. It elevates the lower eyelid, depresses the upper, elevates the lower, which makes sense, right? Because that way the eye is going to close appropriately. A retraction of the lower eyelid and assists in tear transport and drainage. And of course, like all the other muscles we've talked about here, it is the facial nerve, cranial nerve 7, that innervates this muscle. So we can see it here in a couple of diagrams. Here on the top, with this, here's your palpable ligament here. And again, we have these various attachment points as it works its way around. Next is another muscle related to the nasal area called nasalis. It arises from the maxilla and it goes to the cartilage of the nose and the opposite side nasalis muscle. So we can see it here coming across. So again, maxilla here to the cartilage of the nose and the opposite side. So there's some cartilaginous material here where we find attachment and the muscle comes across like so. Now here's one for you can try. See if you can flare your nostrils. Can you open your nostrils? Can you close your nostrils? Yeah, I can wiggle my ears too. Right? So it opens and closes. Believe it or not, we do flare our muscles. Can't do that. Again, it's a sympathetic response. If we're in fight or flight, the nostrils flare to, sense anything through scent and so forth. Okay? Again, facial nerve, cranial nerve 7. Next is called zygomaticus major. We had a zygomatic bone, correct? It arises from the zygomatic bone near the zygomaticotemporal suture. Think of where that is. Zygomaticotemporal suture. Okay? Zygomaticotemporal suture. So where the zygomatic bone somewhat articulates with the temporal bone, okay, to the angle of the mouth just laterally. So you can see it here, how it comes across and gets to the side of the mouth here. You can also see it here. I'm not going to do minor, I'm not particularly concerned with it for our purposes, but we do have major here. It elevates the angle of the mouth, which is when we do what? Smile. Right? Elevates it. It also draws laterally the angle of the mouth. So if you got that real pinched kind of look where the mouth is drawn narrow, it pulls across. Okay? Next is, dental folks here, apologies for my pronunciation here, but I call it the buccinator. I know. How is it called? Buccal. I know. So I don't think it's buccinator. Nope. I've never heard it called that. like the one C's, kind of soft. It attaches at the maxilla and the mandible on the external surfaces at the alveolar processes of the molars. So where again were the alveolar processes? That's what the roots of the teeth go into the bone, right? So maxilla and mandible. So we're talking both upper here and down here. This is your cheekbone, or cheek muscle, if you wish to call it that, okay? Around the alveolar processes of the molars. So back here, think of where your molars go into the maxilla and into the mandible. In around that area is where we find the attachments. And it attaches to the lips just lateral to the angle of the mouth. So we can see it here in this area. And we can also see it in the other diagrams here. So buccinator lies deep to another muscle we'll be talking about soon called masseter, right along here by the teeth back here. And we can see it here as well. Think of it sort of the fleshy cheek, the muscle that's in there between the mucous membranes medially and the skin laterally. It's where you're going to find this muscle lying in the soft tissue there of the cheek, okay? It compresses the cheek against the teeth, and it actually, you don't recognize it when you're actually chewing your food, but it does work in moving your food around your mouth and helping get to the teeth appropriately for, again, the teeth to crush the food and break it down when we're masticating or chewing to be able to, you know, get it to a point where it's chewed up enough that we can swallow it into the digestive system. Orbicularis oris. So we had an orbicularis oculi, which is the oculi, which is eye. Oris is mouth. So oculi is eye, oris is mouth. And the fact that they're both called orbicularis means they're orbital, which means they're a circular muscle. So you have a circular muscle around your eye, and you have a circular muscle around your mouth. This muscle completely surrounds the mouth. It has four parts to it. Two on the upper left, upper and lower, and two on the right, upper and lower. So you have a muscle that you've got part of it upper and lower left and upper and lower right, okay? The fibers of these attachments transverse through the tissue of the upper or the lower lips. So think of them having a right or left and kind of meeting in the center, right? It closes the mouth and protracts the lips when we do what? Kiss. Kissing. Well, this muscle will work with a peck. Okay? All right. That was an easy one. Buccinator, yeah. Okay. So those were muscles of the facial expression, as they stated. Now we need to do muscles related to the skull and face. Some of these are what are called muscles of mastication. So these muscles are involved in moving the mandible up and down, side to side, when we're chewing food. Hence the reason why they're sometimes some of these are called muscles of mastication. So we're going to do those first. We can see here with these drawings, a fair number of muscles exist in this area. And we did the facial muscles. Now we're talking about many other ones, and some of them do lie in the face, but the difference is these muscles attach to bone. Facial muscles, remember, they were involved in the fascia of the face, and they moved the face, but had no bony attachment, right? Whereas these ones were going to be your sort of your traditional sense, where these muscles do have an attachment onto bones to affect the movements, depending on what they're responsible for. We've already talked a little bit about this one, and this one's called temporalis. And remember, you know, it was even on the question, right, on one of the questions of the quiz today or test today. It arises from the temporal fossa. So it's relatively large, basically the whole fossa except the part on the zygomatic bone. And we can see it here. It covers an extreme amount of this entire area. Right? It's quite large on both sides. Of course, we have one on both sides. And it attaches to the coronoid process and ramus of the mandible. Where is that? Where is the coronoid process? This one, right? It attaches here and the ramus of the mandible. What was the ramus? Which one's the ramus? This one or this one? Right. So the coronary process and the ramus. Okay, so that's where this very large space on the lateral aspect of the skull in the temporal area to the ramus and the coronary process. The anterior border, apex, and posterior border and internal surface of the coronary process. Yes, this is how picky we are getting in this course. So it's not good enough just to say it attaches, yeah, kind of here and kind of here. Within the context of the ramus and the coronoid process, it attaches on the anterior border, the apex, the posterior border, and the internal surface of the coronoid process. So here, 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 and back here, not here, back here, okay? As well as the anterior border of the ramus, so down here. So all the way along here, over the top, down the back, and internally here, okay? Its functions, its primary action, and I try to put this in, which is important to remember. Many muscles do play synergistic roles or secondary roles in certain movements, so I'll always list something as being primary and then the ones below. This is an elevator of the mandible at the temporomandibular joint, which means it is a what of the mouth? A closer. It is a closer of the mouth. So quite simply, just take your two fingers, put them in your temporal fossa, and clench your teeth. The temporalis will jump out to meet you. You'll feel it pop, right? Okay? It's a closer. It also retracts the mandible at the TMJ. So, retraction is what? Bringing the jaw backwards. Again, touch your temporalis, both sides, and pull your jaw back. Feel it contract? Right? Not much movement, but it's still there. It's still working. And the anterior fibers elevate the mandible, and the posterior fibers retract the mandible, and the middle fibers do both. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, this is how picky we're getting. Now, that makes sense, right? The anterior fibers elevate, close. The posterior fibers retract. Why? Why does that happen? Let's look at the muscle. Because it's something you need to take to all your other muscles. We said the muscles have striations, correct? Okay. How many people here took physics? Even in high school. What's a vector? Right? And then we have a long or short vector, and what does that represent? Or how strong it is. In this case, right? So when we look at temporalis here, I actually have to dig and find chalk. I can't believe I have to find, I haven't used chalk, and you don't want to see what my chalk looks like. These two things are full of chalk for about 20 years now. They're pretty disgusting inside. Very dusty. And they're all kind of chewed into little tiny pieces. Fundamentally, when we look at the muscle, we see this, right? And then the other side comes all the way down like so. So when we want to draw fibers, and I'm not going to be overly picky here, I'm going to then put in vectors. So we say that, what did we say the anterior fibers do? Elevates. So elevation would be a vector in this direction, correct? And the posterior fibers, they do what? Retract, so that would be a vector in this direction. Can you see how the associated fibers, the way they lay out, are completely the same as those two vectors, correct? So again, when I go back to saying muscles are dumb, it's where they are in their relationship to axes of movements, right? They have that influence because of where they are in relationship to that axis, because for all purposes, the axis is kind of here somewhere, right? Ish. So when your patient comes to you and you ask them to elevate and you resist, or you ask them to protract and you resist, they may say, I have no pain on elevation, but I have pain on retraction. What might that tell you? What might that tell you? I don't have pain on elevation, but I have pain on retraction. Where might the problem lie? Correct. Or middle, because middle does both, right? In other words, if this is why it's so important to understand these sorts of things, if that's the case, no pain on elevation and pain on retraction, then the problem is somewhere there versus anteriorly. Everybody follow me? This is why it's so important that we do get as in-depth as we do, because these kinds of clinical problems that we need to solve generally tend to have to come down to this amount in most cases. Does everybody follow me? Right? So this is the way you have to start thinking in relationship to these fibers. It's no different than glutes or any other muscles. When I start saying that, you know, certain aspects of the muscle are responsible for this, while other aspects of the muscle are responsible for that, and so forth, you do need to know that. It's fundamentally important to when you're rehabbing your patient or trying to, as I say, solve a clinical presentation problem when the patient comes and says, I have pain here or pain there, or I have pain when this happens versus that happens, then, of course, you start to understand why it's so vitally important to understand it down to this level, okay? So hopefully I've stimulated enough to recognize that, oh my God, this seems so picky, but now you kind of know why it's so important, okay? Innervation is the trigeminal nerve, cranial nerve 5, and is part of the deep temporal branch. So we're no longer in 7 facial nerve, we're now in the trigeminal cranial nerve 5. Remember, whenever you see a Roman numeral, that's always a cranial nerve, and remember that a cranial nerve always comes from our cranium, right? Instead of the spine, because nerves that affect muscles either arise from the head or they arise from the spinal cord. Of course, the spinal cord is in relationship to the vertebral column. So if the nerves arise from the spine, they're called spinal nerves. And if they arise from the head, they're called cranial nerves. So you know it's kind of coming from there. Okay? So you can see here, this is a drawing out of your book that you have. And you can see where it is here. And you understand that you can sort of see the attachments here over that coronoid process, posteriorly, anteriorly, superiorly, down the ramus a bit. You're not seeing the inside so much, but you kind of can see how this, the fascia here of the muscle, the tendinous attachment, you can see how it comes down here and has this anterior configuration here with posterior there, okay? It is a very powerful closer. This is why if you're a clincher or a grinder, you'll suffer from headaches in the temporal area. How many people here, when they have a headache, kind of shove their thumbs into their temples and do little circles to relieve the headache, right? Could be that you're clenching or grinding. The stretch is, we have to think about what this does. This stretching is always the opposite of the movement, correct? Because remember, contraction is shortening of the muscle, therefore stretching is lengthening of the muscle. So once you know the actions of the muscle, then you would do the opposite to stretch said muscle, right? Now remember the book we talked about last week, the muscle testing book. You know, quite often the setup you do to test a muscle can also be used, shall we say, somewhat oppositely to stretch the muscle. You use the testing position and setup to isolate the muscle, then rather than having it contract, you would lengthen it or attempt to lengthen it. Does everybody kind of follow me? Have you guys talked a bit about that in lab? Probably not too much yet. But you get the sense of it, right? Trigger points. Overuse of the muscle can result in trigger points, such as nocturnal grinding or clenching. How many people who here chew gum excessively? Stop. It's bad for your jaw. So bad. Every once in a while it's fine, but not a lot. Because what you're doing is take a bicep, take your bicep, give yourself a 4-ounce weight and do this all day. What do you think that bicep's going to feel like at the end of the day? or it could be completely ripped apart and inflamed tendon and so forth, right? Chewing gum's the same thing. I'm contract, 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 contract. It's not good for the muscle, and it sets you up for trigger points in this muscle. Okay? So, trigger points tend to produce headaches, pain, and hypersensitivity of upper teeth and adjacent gums, and pain in the TMJ. I can tell you, it's not unusual at times that these get attributed to dental disease with tooth pain, could be a trigger point that's causing the teeth to ache when in fact there's really nothing wrong with the teeth at all. It's a trigger point in this muscle. Headaches, and you can see, you know, how many people actually have headaches in this pattern from time to time up in that temporal area, right? Yes. Okay. And then, of course, TMJ disorder sometimes gets involved here as well, because one of the trigger points is in that temporal mandibular joint area, can cause pain in that area and dysfunction, right? Now, the thing to remember, when you have a trigger point in a muscle, the muscle is usually shortened, which means that if I had a trigger point in this muscle, it would reduce the amount of range of motion I would normally have in depression. Does everybody follow that? The stretch of muscle with a trigger point in it is usually quite uncomfortable. And remember, a trigger point is caused by what? Chronic contraction. If the muscle is chronically contract, can it stretch well? No. So always remember, if you have an active trigger point in a muscle, the range of motion to lengthen that muscle is likely less than normal simply because it has a trigger point in it. So folks with a trigger point in this muscle, maybe the folks who can't get the three fingers in the mouth. Remember we did the three fingers in the mouth last week, right? These folks can't get three fingers in because of tightness, and it could be just simply this muscle because of a trigger point in it. It's tight and it's not allowing the mouth to open as much as it possibly could. Okay? Any questions on this? This is going to be our life for the next few weeks, doing exactly all this stuff. All right. Next is masseter. Now, masseter, it arises from the inferior margins of the zygomatic bone and the zygomatic arch. So where's the zygomatic bone? And very specifically, where is the zygomatic arch? What does that represent? Right. So this comes, think of the cheek line. This muscle comes underneath, from underneath that zygomatic arch on its superior attachment. And then it goes down to the angle and inferior one half of the external surface of the ramus of the mandible. That is the superficial layer. So where did I put my mandible? Oh, here it is. Right, so we see here, we say the zygomatic bone and the zygomatic arch. You guys have a full skull there, so you can, you know, get a sense of where that lies underneath that zygomatic bone. And then it comes down to the angle and inferior one half of the external surface of the ramus of the mandible. So out here. Okay, so it's out here. All right. That's the superficial. The deep layer arises from the inferior margin of the deep surface of the zygomatic arch. And it goes to the external surface of the coronoid process, the superior one half of the external surface of the ramus of the mandible. So you can see here, we've got the two, right? We've got, here is the deep head lying here, okay? And here is the superficial head. So when we look here in this picture, the superficial head has been removed. We can see the superficial head here, remembering inferior margins of the zygomatic bone and the arch to the D angle and inferior one half to the external surface of the ramus. So this is the superficial here. The deep is the inferior margin and deep surface of the zygomatic arch. So you can see how it's much, you know, this you can almost palpate the superficial head along just by palpating along the mandible, around the zygomatic arch. But to get to the deep head, you can see how much deeper it is. It lies far deeper, kind of underneath, or it lies posterior or deep to the superficial head, but still at that zygomatic arch, but much deeper into the zygomatic arch. So if you were to look at that zygomatic arch, you could in fact suggest that you would have your superficial head kind of lined, you know, here on this aspect of the arch, and then your deep head would be far deeper along that arch down in here, right? Everybody follow? Yeah. Yes, not so much this muscle. You can get to the deep head a little bit. It's the next muscle that we spend time really having an effect on by working inside. Although some experts say we can't palpate it. Always somebody, right, wants to spoil the party. So this is also an elevator, meaning it's a closer. So we have temporalis, it's a closer, and we have masseter, both heads working together, is a closer, right? That's its primary action. It also protracts the mandible at the TMJ and retracts the mandible at the TMJ. How does it do that? Anterior fibers will pull the jaw forward. Posterior fibers and the deep head will pull back the jaw, right? Again, it's all about vectors when we line up the muscle to the movement of the joint itself, okay? Its innervation is the trigeminal nerve, cranial nerve 5, but the anterior trunk. Temporalis was the deep temporal branch, and masseter is the anterior trunk. Yes, I do ask questions like that. Well, explain what? Innervation. Okay, so you have nerves that come out of the brain. Remember all the little holes we yet to learn in the base of the skull, right? So when nerves come out, they branch. And depending on where they go, they have very specific names. We say cranial nerve 5 because the branch that we're talking to, if we backtrack it, it came out and goes all the way back to cranial nerve 5 before it branches out, okay? Once the nerve leaves the skull and starts to branch, then we have to determine this branch goes to that branch goes to this muscle, and so forth. That's why they're slightly different, okay? So if you had something that significantly damaged cranial nerve 5, all the muscles innervated by 5, if the damage is bad enough, would all paralyze or all go flaccid, and that's when you get, you know, a whole face would droop. Whereas if you found that temporalis was working fine, but masseter seemed to be weak and wasn't functioning, then you have to go all the way back to say, okay, it's the anterior trunk that got affected of this nerve, not any of the other branches. Yeah, so it branches out. So each muscle will have a different branch of the nerve that it innervates, right? So again, you go back to the major nerve, damage would affect all the muscles that are innervated by the nerve. But if you went out into the branches, a singular damage to a branch will only affect those muscles that it innervates, while all the other branches would still function fine. Is this like an oh my God moment? Like, not in a good way? Yes. Yes. Anterior fibers. So would pro, no, posterior fibers would retract and anterior fibers would protract. Right, yeah. Okay, you can see if they're running this way, right, they're going to pull forward. Okay, and again, if you just put your fingers right at that mandibular angle and again, clench your teeth, you'll feel this muscle will come. And in fact, if you are a clencher, I bet you I could walk around and find a few trigger points in this muscle. Some of you are already tender, just rubbing it now, right? Yes. Stretch is exactly the same as it was for temporalis, simply because this is a closer or an elevator, the same as temporalis is. Trigger points are different, and this is why it's so important to understand the trigger point patterns, because when we go back and we look at temporalis, we see this very specific pattern. If we go to masseter, it's an entirely different pattern of pain, isn't it? So one of the things that's great is if you're suspecting a trigger point, when the patient tells you they have pain in their head or they have a headache, of course you always ask, where do you have your headache? And where they point to or the description of the pain pattern they give you, if you're good at these, you'll go, sounds like masseter to me. And that just starts you being better prepared to come to a clinical decision as to what you think is going on with your patient. Make sense? Right? That's why they're so important. So, again, nocturnal grinding or clenching, gum chewing. Now, something called occlusal asymmetry. This is your teeth unable to kind of align properly with each other. And it makes sense, right? If your teeth are out, or sorry, I shouldn't say that. It's not your teeth. If your jaw is out in relationship from lower jaw to upper jaw, then that's going to put stress on the muscles and they'll start to get irritated and possibly have trigger points, again, because they're struggling, right? They're getting overused. Trigger points tend to produce restricted depression of the mandible, same as temporalis, pain and hypersensitivity of the upper and lower molar teeth and adjacent gums, pain in the TMJ. If this muscle is tight enough, it can in fact actually pull the mandible out of place, and when the patient closes their mouth, their teeth won't exactly come together properly. There'll be a shift. And the other thing that this can cause, which may seem odd to begin with, it can cause tinnitus. Now, what is tinnitus? Ringing in the ears. This trigger point can cause ringing in the ears. Yes. Yeah. Okay. These trigger points are often misdiagnosed as a TMJ disorder, dental disease, headaches, or sinusitis. Okay. Any questions? You can see here you've got a pattern here over the eye into the external auditory meatus area of the ear, the cheek, the teeth, and it really depends on where the trigger points are. Down here is the superficial head. You have four points here. Up here is the deeper head. You can see kind of in there. Okay? Okay. This is one of my favorite muscles, lateral pterygoid. You have a lateral pterygoid and you have a medial pterygoid. Okay, lateral meaning it must be more lateral, of course. This arises from the sphenoid bone to the mandible and the temporal mandibular joint. The superior head, so it has two heads to it, the superior head goes from the greater wing of the sphenoid to the capsule and articular disc of the TMJ. Do you remember me talking about the TMJ last week? And I said there's a muscle that actually attaches to the disc that when the muscle contracts, the disc moves with the mandible so that you get appropriate relationship between the articular process of the mandible and the part of the temporal bone, right? Because without the disc, you would have convexity against convexity, and of course that wouldn't be a very congruent joint. So this is the muscle that actually pulls the disc on opening. So the superior head is the greater wing of the sphenoid to the capsule and articular disc of the TMJ. The inferior head is from the lateral surface of the lateral pterygoid plate of the pterygoid process of the sphenoid to the neck of the mandible. So where's the neck of the mandible? Just below the articular process of the mandible, right? So we can see here's our two heads that we have here. Again, the upper head, we're finding here a sphenoid to the disc and the capsule, and then the inferior head, of course, here we said is the lateral surface of the pterygoid plate of the pterygoid process of the sphenoid to the neck of the mandible. So up here to the disc and the articular capsule, and here to the neck of the mandible itself. Right. So because we have yes. Yes, very deep to it. Yes, masseter would lay over top of it. So masseter, you can see they've actually cut part of the ramus and the body of the mandible away so we can see these muscles. It's very, very deep too, right? So you can somewhat affect it from outside, but this would be a muscle we'd go to when we work intraorally. Okay. What's that? Oh, I've actually, anybody here been dry needled? Yes. So I have occasionally, because I clench, I'm a clencher, I have some TJ issues. She actually takes one of the dry needles and she puts it all the way through in the lateral pterygoid. So I have these needles going all the way through, and then it's left there for 15 minutes. And it feels amazing. It just calms the muscle right down. It's awesome. I actually took a picture of myself because it was so freaky. I had these huge needles coming out of my face. And then, not as much as you think. No, it's like an acupuncture needle. So it's almost the diameter of a hair. And they tap it in and they put it in. So it's not overly, I mean, it's sore in the muscle and initially goes into the sore muscle, but then it just goes, and it's great. So because of that configuration, this protracts the mandible at the TMJ, okay, and contralaterally deviates the mandible at the TMJ. So bilaterally, it causes that. And unilaterally, it causes that. Now, let's think of where this is. We've got the jaw here, and we've got its attachments on the sphenoid bone, which are slightly anterior to it, as we saw in the diagram, right? I'll put the diagram up. Okay? So we've got muscles that are kind of coming this way, correct? All right. When they work bilaterally, meaning that when both the right and left contract at the same time, the mandible comes anteriorly, it protracts. When it's working unilaterally, it causes deviation. So the question is, which one contracts when I want to go right? Good. The left. Does everybody see that? Right? Because the muscle's in this direction, one gets closer to the other. When the left contracts, it goes right. When the right contracts, it goes left. Yes, no, maybe. So, if we look at it a bit this way, so this would represent the mandible, and then what we'll do is we'll say this is the sphenoid here. This muscle goes like so, doesn't it? Right? It comes from the sphenoid to the mandible. So when these are going to contract, the two attachments are going to get closer together, correct? So we're going to get this kind of movement, right? So you can see that when this left one contracts, right, which way is it going to move? Right, it's going to move to the right. You see that? Right, because it's actually going this way, which means it's going to result in that way. Yes? You see that? Because these two are getting together, right? So it's going to be opposite because you're driving the coronoid process closer to the sphenoid. Maybe that'll help you. The coronoid process is getting closer to the sphenoid, so therefore, just put your finger on your ramus and deviate to the right. You can feel that coronoid process traveling anteriorly, can't you? Right? Okay. All right. So lateral deviation, opposite side, anterior, inferior, and lateral glide of the mandibular head and disc, ipsilateral deviation, same side, posterior, superior, medial glide of the mandibular head. So you can see here, now you can run that, it's just a picture of myself doing it so you can see it moving. Protraction, retraction, of course, extending the jaw or tongue forward, retraction, bringing the jaw or tongue backward. And you can see there in that picture, I'm anteriorly, and then I move posteriorly. So, stretch is here, right? You're moving it which way? If I push to the same side, I'm making it somewhat stretch because I'm moving the coronoid process farther away, correct? Okay. Trigger points. Again, gum chewing, grinding, whatever, tend to produce pain felt deeply in the TMJ. Crepitus in the TMJ because the TMJ is not functioning well. Remember, I kind of talked a little bit last week about when this muscle is tight and has trigger points, it can pull the disc kind of in an awkward way in relationship to the articular process of the mandible. So therefore, you get that clicking sound. Crepitus means joint sound, clicking. And occlusal asymmetry, same as the others, tingling in the cheek or weakness of the buccinator muscle. And again, it can be diagnosed as TMJ disorder, sinusitis, tic de la rue, which you'll take in PEP class, or ear infections. So that was lateral pterygoid. Now we're going to go deeper and go to medial pterygoid. And we can see it here, right? Lateral pterygoid, we're looking from the back of the head to the inside of the mandible and the maxilla. You can see that lateral pterygoid is out here. You can see it here. And you can see that this muscle lies medial, on the medial aspect of the ramus of the mandible. So on the inside, you can see it here. hence the reason why it's called the medial pterygoid rather than the lateral. And again, it has it related to the pterygoid plate in the sphenoid. So the D-pad in the sphenoid, it arises from the medial surface of the lateral pterygoid plate of the pterygoid process of the sphenoid, the palatine bone, and the tuberosity of the maxilla. Where's the palatine bone? Yes. So all the way up into that area, okay? And the superficial head arises from the palatine bone and the maxilla. They both come together to a single distal attachment to the internal surface of the mandible at the angle and the inferior border of the ramus of the mandible on that medial surface or that interior surface. We can't get in and palpate this guy. It's kind of in there a little bit too much. But we can affect change when we work intraorally just from the association of the tissues. Its innervation is the trigeminal nerve, cranial nerve 5, mandibular division. I don't think I did the innervation for pterygoid, did I? It is the trigeminal nerve, cranial nerve 5. The lateral pterygoid nerve is for lateral pterygoid. And, of course, for medial pterygoid, we have the mandibular division here because it's deeper to it. It's deeper inside, okay? Stretch, you can see here we move down because it's a bit of a, you're trying to get that coronoid process just that little bit farther away. And if you want to stretch here, you're moving it in and towards. You can see here that by moving it down this way on the same side, you'll get the stretch on it. Trigger points with masseter, basically diffuse aching pain in the mouth, and you can get pain in the tongue and throat. TMJ, occlusal asymmetry, pressure or pain felt deeply in the air, pain or difficulty when swallowing, or restricted depression at the TMJ. Quite often, again, it's misdiagnosed as possible headaches, ear infections, head colds, or sinusitis. Any questions on those? Those are the major ones you need to know because those are the ones you're going to be working on when you're actually doing TMJ treatments. Now, I said that I would talk a little bit about the hyoid bone last week, so we can see it sits here in the mid-neck. It floats, actually, to some degree. So we say it's found in the interior neck at the C3 level. It's extremely mobile as it has no direct articulation with another bone. Anybody here want to come up who hasn't got a bad gag reflex? You're going to be palpating this in lab anyway, so I might as well show you the first time. Who wants to come up? I prefer a male if I could, only because you have a larger thyroid cartilage, and it'd be a bit easier for me to show. What am I getting into here? No, it's not that. Okay, so the reason I'm doing this is because quite often you get these palpations in your final OP, and everybody goes to the thyroid cartilage, which is right here, right? This is, you know, that little looks like the spout of a jug. And, you know, in males, it's larger, right? So that's why we have deeper voices, because it represents the larynx, which is our voice box, basically. But this bone actually sits higher. So you can see here in the diagram, here is your larynx or your thyroid cartilage here, representing that Adam's apple, if you want to use that term for now. This lies superior to it. And this is the mistake students often make, is that you've got to find this thyroid cartilage, and then you have to get up above it. And it is the piece of bone. Okay, and I'm on it now, and it's horseshoe shaped. You can see it there in the bottom right, but I want to show you how movable it is. Okay, not too bad. It's a bit crunchy, but not too bad, right? Okay, all right, thanks. Okay, so it's get above that thyroid cartilage and get around it. You have to get in at it. Okay. Right, yes. Because some people get gaggy. When you get in there, I just didn't want anybody to be suddenly going, when I'm attempting to palpate it. And you're going to have to palpate it in class and be palpated, so you'll eventually get to it. Brian's first self-defense thing here. This thing snaps like a twig, right? So if you ever find yourself in a situation, you can either karate chop it or just grab it with your hand and just squeeze, and it'll snap like a twig. And they'll drop like a sack of potatoes. You don't always have to punch and kick. Just know your anatomy, and you can do some terrible things to people just quite simply. Okay. You know, have you had, did anybody remember the movie Scent of a Woman with Al Pacino? You remember that? Yeah, he does a ranger lock, and that's what they do. They actually grab the entire trachea and the larynx that, like this, and they can just crush it. Yeah, no kidding, right? So, being that it's so mobile, it's because it doesn't attach to any other bone. It actually is attached by soft tissue, ligaments, and lots of muscle attachment. It is suspended by muscles that connect to the mandible, styloid processes, thyroid cartilage, manubrium of the sternum, and the scapula. It is somewhat bound to the thyroid cartilage with tendinous-like tissue. Muscles that originate above the hyoid bone are called suprahyoid muscles, and muscles that originate from below the hyoid bone, of course, are called infrahyoids. And I did give you that little bit of that list last week, right, in one of the slides. Okay. We can see them here. So let's do the suprahyoids first. The first is called digastric. It arises, has two bellies. It has a posterior belly and an anterior belly. The posterior arises from the mastoid notch of the temporal bone, so near that mastoid process. What's that? Oh. Are you missing one? Why, did I divide it into part two?
Yeah, I was
Oh.
There's two PowerPoints, so this is the second PowerPoint now.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry. Okay. It goes from the mastoid notch of the temporal bone all the way up near that mastoid process to the hyoid itself. The central tendon is bound to the hyoid bone at the body and the greater cornu horn. So if we go back here, we can see when we look at this hyoid bone, it is U-shaped. It has a body anteriorly, and it has horns. It has two thin ones that come up from the body superiorly, and two large ones posteriorly back, like so. So we can see here we've got the body here. We have the lesser horn traveling superiorly. We have the greater horn traveling posteriorly. So when I say here that the hyoid, the central tendon is bound to the hyoid bone at the body and the greater horn or cornu, which would be the body and the greater horn, not the lesser. Everybody follow me? Okay. The anterior belly arises from the inner surface of the inferior border of the mandible to the central tendon at the hyoid bone and the body and the greater cornu. So we can see it here. Here is digastric. Here, this is the posterior belly arising from near that mastoid process, coming down with its central tendon to this body and greater cornu. And here is the anterior belly coming from underneath the masseter down to its the same central tendon, right at the, again, the body and the greater cornu. And you can see it's all wrapped in into this sort of this ligament that holds on to it. You can see it here as well. Here is the posterior belly of digastric, and here is the anterior belly of digastric here. So it's relatively superficial, coming along underneath through here with this central tendon that has sort of got a sleeve over top of it that holds it down at this body and greater horn of the hyoid bone. Okay? It functions, it depresses the mandible at the TMJ, so it does pull the mandible down when it's contracting. It retracts the mandible at the TMJs, but when the mandible is somewhat fixed, because of its attachment from the jaw up into the skull at the mastoid process, bilaterally they can also do this at the spinal joints. Okay, it's one of the first muscles that we're talking can affect the C-spine. It extends the head at the atlanto-occipital joint as well, depending if it's one way or the other. So we can see here, I thought I had, when you're looking at the head here, and this is the mastoid process and the styloid process, you do have the two occipital condyles back here. And of course, I said that that's the articulation of C1 to the underside of the cranium itself, although it's on the occipital bone, still that's its attachment. So when we look at saying yes, right, we're talking about the articulation between the skull on C1. So that's our axis of movement, right? Remember, a muscle has to cross a joint in order to affect a joint. So because it's down here, where are we here? It's down here. These muscles actually, because they cross those spinal joints, they allow for flexion because they can move the head on the spinal column. You can see the occipital condyles actually right here on either side, and you can see that these muscles cross that joint, therefore they're going to affect that joint because C1 will articulate with the occiput at the occipital condyles to create that joint, and those muscles cross it, okay? I've got to go back here. All right. It's reverse motor action. This is the first time we're seeing this. So because of its attachments, both posterior and anterior, or in some cases muscles superior, inferior, we can always fix one attachment which causes movement at another. In this case, if we fix the posterior belly at the mastoid process area, and we also fix it at the inside of the mandible, if those don't move, contraction of these two muscles will lift the hyoid bone. Does everybody understand? If I fix the head and its other attachments and the muscles still contract, it is the hyoid bone that will move, not the head. So this is what we say when the head and jaw are fixed, then if the muscle contracts, it's the hyoid bone that moves. And so because we've fixed the attachments for different movements, we call it a reverse action. So its primary action is to, right? Its primary action is to depress the mandible and to flex the head and neck of the spinal joints as primary. When those two are fixed, then the only other movement that occurs is that these two muscles affect that the hyoid bone will actually lift. Okay? Now, its innervation. The anterior belly has a different innervation as compared to the posterior. The anterior belly is the trigeminal nerve, cranial nerve 5, and the facial nerve, with the anterior belly having the myeloid branch of cranial nerve 5, and the posterior belly being the facial nerve 5. You know the study guide it gave you that had all little boxes all laid out that says muscle, attachments, actions, innervation, and so forth? For a lot of you, that might be the best way to do all this. Because I know all of you are like, holy cow, how am I going to remember all of this, right? You've got to chart it out somehow, maybe. For me, like I told you guys about my bathroom when I went to school, right? Right? On the mirror, and I was a drawer. I had to draw all these muscles. So I had, for example, I would have a card of the face, just like that, and I would draw one muscle with everything on it, and then the next muscle, everything on it, then the next muscle, everything on it. So I filled up the entire, because it was a big, huge mirror, I filled up the entire mirror. It just worked for me. And then every day, shaving. I only did 3 muscles that week. Then the next week, well, we actually had this class twice in a week when I went to school. And I just kept every day just going through, right? This is memorization. How many people here have taken? I know a couple of you have. It's just straight memorization. You just have to go over it and over it and over it and over it and over it.
It's essentially that chart is like a reflection of how you'll
answer.
You usually give us the hints on.
Yeah, sometimes. I will have... Sometimes questions for this stuff is, I'll give you, for example, because there's no trigger points for these muscles, but I will say here, which of the following will describe the referral pattern of masseter or whatever, and I'll use some of these that you'll have to know. So I'll ask questions that way. Sometimes I'll say, which of the following muscles has this as its primary action? Sometimes I have, I will occasionally show something like this and say, what muscle is, well, it won't have the X marks the spot, but it's a referral pattern. I'll say, what muscle is this, the trigger point pattern for? Or which of the following muscles are innervated by cranial nerve 10 or 5 or whatever it may be. All right. Well, I'll just keep moving on with all this stuff starting next week. Okay, we'll have a whole 3 hours of it. So, yes, we didn't get to it today, but we will definitely be into the spine next week. Okay, so make sure you bring your spine too.
Is there a reason why it's called digastric? Anything to do with gastric?
No. Just a dive means two, and I guess belly, I guess, that's a guess, but the die does mean two for sure, right?
Yes.